So we tackled the first seven verses already in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And in a nutshell, what it's mostly about there is determining what you are gifted for. You know, trying to figure out how you are wired as an individual. We're just wired differently. The majority of us are going to be gifted for marriage. That means that's where our passions and desires are going to lie. We're going to have that desire to get married and then have a marital sex life within that marriage. And if that's the case, then Paul would say probably in general, your best course of action, if you are so gifted, is just to go ahead and do that. To go ahead and find that someone special in the Lord, bite the bullet and pop the question. Just get married. That's probably going to be the best route for you to go. Others, and I would say precious few, have the gifting to live a single and celibate lifestyle. Some of them are actually asexual. They don't have sexual passions or desires at all, or very little. And so that is the lifestyle that they are called and gifted for. That is how they are wired. They just don't really want to get married. They don't want to have kids. They don't want to have a family. They just want to live a single and celibate lifestyle. And if that's the case, boy, you got a fan in Paul, because he really loves that approach. He thinks that's like the best route to go. It was the route that Paul found himself in. Having been married, he is now single and celibate. And you've read through this probably, you know, a little bit ahead, or you've read it in the past. So, you know, he just constantly takes those not so subtle jabs at letting you know that he prefers that every person be like him, single and celibate. He's just going to constantly get those not so subtle expressions of his preference in there. But though it seemed best to Paul from a spiritual standpoint for everyone to just stay single and focus on their relationship with the Lord, he does concede in verses 1 through 7 that generally people are going to need to figure out how they are gifted and then just stick with those giftings. Because when you don't, it's like fish out of water, or, you know, fish maybe swimming upstream would be a better metaphor. You're going against the grain of your nature, how God designed you, obviously what he purposed for you. So it's probably just best in all situations, regardless of Paul trying to press us to be single and celibate if we can. Safest bet is just figure out what it is that your passions are set to and then pursue that. That's where you're going to find the most fulfillment in your life. Now, within marriage, Paul then counsels us on how we can lessen temptations outside of the marriage. And he says you do that by regular sex within the marriage. That's going to help you. That's going to curb your passions and therefore your temptations outside of the marriage. And then Paul gave us some guidelines for that. And just to put this really quickly, basically, Paul was saying you have to first accept that your spouse has joint ownership of your body. So you can't deprive your spouse of the sexual gratification that they are seeking from you. As I shared with you last week, if your spouse wants your body, by all means, give your spouse your body. I mean, you've been married for how long? Your spouse is still attracted to you. They still want you sexually. What are you waiting for? Why are you dragging your feet? Why are you depriving your spouse? Just go for it. And that would be Paul's counsel, maybe less so crude, but that would be Paul's counsel. Don't deprive each other sexually. And if you're going to do that, if you're going to cease from sex within the marriage, Paul gives us three parameters to keep that within. Number one, it needs to be very temporary, very temporary. This cannot be a long-term decision. You cannot, as we said last week, determine to be a nun or a priest after you've been married. Sorry, you've already made that decision. You got married. So number one, it needs to be very temporary. Number two, it needs to be mutually agreed upon. And then number three, it needs to be for spiritual purposes. Now this morning, we're going to pick up at verse 8 and probably get to verse 12 up to it, and may start into verse 12, probably not. But we are going to go ahead and move through this slowly. And the good reason to do that is because there is no other location in the Bible where you're going to find a bulk teaching about all of these subjects of Christian sexuality other than right here, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. This is it. Almost every time that you're going to talk about those topics in any other passage in the Bible, you're going to want to point yourself back to this chapter. Paul is very thorough here. And I will add, he is very technical. And I hesitate to go into the kind of technical detail that we're going to this morning and probably next week and probably for the 20 weeks to follow, however long it takes us. But it is a really good thing for us to do. If this, you know, all of the technical talk, if it is hurting your brain, I would just say hang in there. We're going to get the majority of this for this week over in the first section before we even begin reading. And then it gets a little easier after that. So just dial in as best as you can. Try to understand what I'm saying. And if not, again, you can listen to these messages as many times as you need to for it to make sense. And eventually, I think it would. I hope. Unless I really mess up at my calling and ministry this morning. So this chapter is going to tell us pretty much everything that we could want to know on these topics. It won't cover everything. It will brush us up against a few other things, but as a bonus for you being here this morning, I'm going to go ahead and throw in that other stuff for free. I'm going to go ahead and include it. Now that said, let's get started with this. There are four words that we all need to learn as we are studying 1 Corinthians chapter 7, especially verses 8 through the end of the chapter. Those four words are used repeatedly, and if we're going to be accurate with our interpretation and application of what Paul's teaching us, then it all starts right there with these four words. The first is the word married. It comes from the Greek word gamos. And it's where we get our English words monogamous and polygamous. So you can hear the root in there. Obviously, gamos means married. Mono means one. Poly means many. So monogamous means married to one. Polygamous means married to many, right? Well, that Greek root word gamos means married. The second one is the word widow. It is the Greek word kerais. And that is a person that at one time was married, but now they are single because their spouse has died. The third is the word betrothed in the ESV, or virgin in the King James Version and New King James Version. And I want to admit that overall I do not like the word choice that the ESV has used here. I don't really care much for this word betrothed, because this is the Greek word parthenos, singular, or parthenoi, plural. And it was used in two ways in the Greek language. It was used to, number one, speak of a person that was a virgin to sex, or number two, a person that was virgin to marriage. And Paul does not use it or care about it in the sexual sense. This is not a virgin sexually that he's talking about. He's talking about someone that is a virgin to marriage. So it's much more accurate if we say it this way, that Paul, when the ESV uses the word betrothed, what Paul was actually talking about there is a person that was single, celibate, and had never been married. To understand how the ESV is using this word betrothed, you need to first understand this in the cultural setting. In this culture, if a person was living a single, celibate, never been married life, then that meant more than likely, almost certainly, they were betrothed to be married. It just really didn't work any other way in that culture. Parents planned marriages out so you could be like 2 years old and be betrothed. Or you could be still in the womb and you could be betrothed to be married. So it just kind of goes without saying that someone that had never been married before, that they would be in this state of betrothal. But for us, it's confusing to us because we don't use the words that way. We're not the same kind of culture. So I think it's more accurate if we just spell this out as much as we can. When we come to that word betrothed, that we make sure we point out that this means the single, celibate, never been married person. The fourth word, if you thought that was complicated, is even worse, and it is the word unmarried. I know it sounds super simple. Trust me, it's not. It is the Greek word agamos. Sound familiar? We just had the word gamos, which means married. Now we have the word agamos. What does agamos married? What does agamos mean? Well, when you add an A or an alpha in the Greek language to any Greek word, what that does is that makes that word a negative. It puts that word at a deficit. Let me give you some examples. The word Gnostic means knowledge. So if you stick an alpha in front of Gnostic, now you've got the word agnostic. And what does agnostic mean? It means without knowledge, which is a perfect word for agnostics. Without knowledge. People without knowledge. You have the word theist. And theist means a person that believes in God. Now, if you stick an alpha, on the beginning of that word, now you have the word atheist. What does atheist mean? A person that does not believe in God. Or in other words, a person without belief in God. So you add an A, you need to add the word without. If gamos means married, what does agamos mean? It means without marriage. So unmarried then, right? Well, here's where it gets a little bit more tricky. Paul does not put the never been married or the widows in the category of the unmarried. He keeps this all extremely separate. Paul never uses the word agamos to speak about those different category groups. Paul keeps all four of these words completely separate. These are separate categories of people. Married people, never been married people, widowed people, and unmarried people. So it would be those who were at one time married and now they're not, but their spouses are still alive. They're not widows. So what does unmarried mean then? If you boil it all down, what category of people are left? Divorced people. Yeah, that's it. So when we read the word unmarried, what Paul is actually speaking about with that word agamos is the folks that are divorced. And this chapter is the only part of the entire New Testament where this word agamos appears. So we can't refer to how some other Bible author used the word. All we have is Paul and 1 Corinthians chapter 7. But if we look at what Paul does with this word in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, it's very clear that this unmarried category is for the folks that do not qualify as never been married. They do not qualify as widows. These are folks that then, by necessity, by context, have been married but are no longer married. They are divorced people. The best way to look at it as you're reading that word unmarried in this chapter is look at it like this. They were at one time married and then they unmarried their living spouse. That's the best way to remember what this word exactly means as you're studying it. So you'll want to ask the question, I'm sure. Well, couldn't it just be someone who lost their husband to death? And the answer to that would be no, it couldn't be that. Because look at verse 8, for example, where we're going to begin. Paul has these two categories as separate categories indeed. He says, to the unmarried and the widows. Well, okay, you say, but couldn't it refer to someone who has never been married before? And to that I would say, no. Paul has those two in separate categories as well. Look quickly down at verse 34, and he says there in verse 34, the unmarried or the betrothed. So, and betrothed is the word for single, celibate, never been married. If you need more confirmation on this interpretation, no problem. Paul actually gives us the definition of unmarried in verse 11. If you look at verse 11 quickly, it says, in my own words, that if a woman permanently separates from her living husband, she becomes what? Unmarried. That's the word, agamos. She becomes unmarried. She was married. She has now unmarried her husband. We would call that divorced. So if nothing else, you look at verse 11 and you have to agree that the word unmarried does include divorced people, okay? If you do not believe me that what I'm saying is true, that this word agamos used by Paul always means divorced, okay, fine. I won't argue with you too much. But You have to confess when we get to verse 11 that this category, unmarried, it does include the folks who have divorced, okay? And that's important because regardless of where we stand on the definition of agamos, at verse 11, we're all on the same page that what Paul is teaching about the widows, the unmarried, he is certainly including the folks that have been divorced. And that changes the scope of this. That changes the interpretation of this. It changes all of our considerations, all of the examples, the potential examples that we might want to run through the course of our thinking. It changes all of that because it is a big deal when we start talking about what is appropriate and what's not for divorced people. So one more time, very quickly, and then we're going to get going here. Married. Married. What does married mean? It means married. Widow. What does widow mean? It means widow. First two are super easy, right? Betrothed. What does betrothed mean? Single, celibate, never been married. Unmarried. What does that mean? I am fully convinced it means everyone that's left from those categories, which would be the divorced folks. But for sure, it includes the divorced folks. So let's begin reading at verse 8. Paul says, to the married and the widows. Now, Paul does not include the betrothed there, those who are single, celibate, and have never been married, because he's going to include them later on in the chapter. He's going to end up giving the same basic counsel for them. There's going to be some caveats, but he's going to go through it separately, handle them separately. And as we look at this very technically, we understand why he's doing that. He doesn't want to leave question marks. Right now, Paul is specifically speaking in verse 8 to divorced people and widowed people. In other words, here's where he starts with this. He starts by talking to those who have experience in marriage, those that are used to being in marriage relationships. And now, for one of these two reasons, they have found themselves in a position where they are living a single lifestyle. We already know that's going to be a problem, right? So we need to hear what Paul's going to say. Reading on in verse 8, he says, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. We're only 8 verses into this. Paul has already told us twice now, yeah, if you really can, I think the best thing to do is just stay single. So he's championing once again the single and celibate unmarried lifestyle. This time, specifically to divorcees and widows. So he's saying, you were married, you're divorced now, or your spouse has died, and here's my recommendation, try the single life. Give it a shot. You might find out that after all of this time of being married, now you're not, you might find out that your gifting is changing a little bit, and that your preferred lifestyle now maybe isn't within a marital relationship. And you remember from last week, I told you that, yes, the Lord can change up that gifting in our life. You may be gifted for marriage when you're young, but after you've been married for a while and you find yourself in a single state, you may find that gifting, that passion, that desire, that wiring in your DNA has changed. And you no longer want to be married. Two common examples would be the widow that just immortalizes the spouse that they lost, and they can't get past that spouse. You know, they saw their faults when they were alive, but after they passed, they can't see their faults anymore. That's the perfect spouse. They're immortalized in their thinking, and they're just ruined for anyone else. They don't want to be married. They don't want to try it again. I totally get that one. There's another common situation, and that would be that a spouse has divorced, and the experience with that spouse that they divorced from was so bad that it has ruined them as well for marriage. Like, it's to the point where they say, you know, that's it. I was married, I'm divorced now, and that bozo that I was married to, they have ruined marriage for me. I am done with men, I am done with women, as the case may be. And I'd rather be single and live a single life. Okay, there you go. In both of those cases, your gifting has changed. You're now suited for something different than you once were. So you have to pay attention to that. That's why Paul's saying, don't just rush back out and get married because at one time you knew you wanted to be married. Think about this. Give it some time. See how things go. you might find that your passions and desires have changed in regard to marriage. Verse 9, but, you know, I really, really wish you guys would just stay single, but if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. It just cracks me up every time I read that verse. It is better to marry than to burn with passion. I've shared with you before that when I first read that verse, it was in the King James Version. That was what I cut my teeth on when I got saved. I was trying to understand the King James Version. And that verse in the King James Version says, it's better to marry than to burn. And I literally thought that meant it's slightly better to get married than it is to go to hell. And it made total sense to me because Paul's just constantly downing marriage. No, don't get married. Stay single. And now he gets there and he says, well, if you gotta get married, do it. I mean, it's a little better than hell. But no, that's not what Paul's meaning. The New King James Version corrected that. The ESV maintains that correction. He's talking about burning with passion. That is, you're single and you're trying to stay single, but your lusts, your desire for sex, it's just overwhelming. It's killing you. You're not beating it very well, at least not very easily. And you do have to keep in mind, too, that just the lustful thoughts, that alone is sin according to the law. So you're sinning if you're just having lustful thoughts. Paul says, probably a good idea, instead of wrestling with all of that, just get married. And this is right back to where we started in verses 1 through 7. This time, this truth is for divorced folks and widows. See how Paul's doing this all separately? Is he repeating himself? Yes, because he's handling each category differently. And what we have here in verse 9 is a very important overarching truth about the human condition. And unfortunately, many Christians do not want to acknowledge this truth when they are dealing with the situation of divorce. They're happy to apply this truth to everyone else, especially the more traditional groups. But if you're divorced, I don't know if this really applies to you. Well, it does apply. It applies everywhere. This is a truth about the human condition universally. It's always going to be the case. There are obvious cases where a spouse has been sexually unfaithful to the marriage, and we understand that the Lord, in that situation, gives the permission for that marriage to end in divorce, and then for both of those folks to go out and remarry. We first see that appear all the way back in the Law of Moses, Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4. That was a little bit unclear. So, you know, the Jews wrestled with that for a long time. Moses said if a man marries someone and finds uncleanness in her, that he can write her a bill of divorcement. He can send her away, he can put her away, he can divorce her, and then go out and marry another one. And that so perplexed the Jewish nation for a long time, they kind of developed into two different camps, Rabbi Hillel and Rabbi Shammai. Hillel, the conservative, no, pardon me, Hillel the liberal, Shammai the conservative. Hillel said, oh, when Moses said you can divorce her for uncleanness, what he meant is anything that seems unclean to you. So, you know, like if she is not real good with hygiene, man, you can ditch her. You can divorce her. If she oversalts your eggs, literally, that was in their rabbinical writings. If she oversalts your eggs, she's assaulted you as a man. You can divorce her. And of course, Shammai was the conservative. He said, no, Moses didn't mean any of that. All that Moses meant by uncleanness was sexual uncleanness. And that if your wife is sexually unclean, if she commits an act of fornication or adultery against your marriage, then you can divorce her and remarry someone else. And she's free to divorce as well, according to Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. Well, when Jesus came along, they asked Jesus that question. A lot of confusion over it. Jesus clarified it. Matthew chapter 19, specifically verse 9, he made it super clear that what Moses was talking about, yes, it was sexual unfaithfulness only. It was fornication. If your wife had committed an affair against you, you were free to divorce her and you were free to get married and she was free as well. Now, that is an exception clause for divorce. The Lord just, you know, he hits this with the gold standard and says, I hate divorce, don't do it. And then, when pressed, Moses gives the permission for folks to divorce for the reason of the sexual unfaithfulness of their spouse, as we're told in Deuteronomy 24, for the purpose of a spouse that's been cheated against, they end up with a hard heart toward their spouse. They just struggle to forgive their spouse for that affair. And so Jesus said, because of the hardness of your hearts, okay, you can divorce the one that has cheated on you. And Paul's going to give us another exception clause, right? So that's one exception clause. Don't divorce, God hates it. But if your spouse is unfaithful, yes, you can divorce and you can remarry. That's one exception clause. What's the other one? Paul's going to give it to us in this chapter. The other one is the abandonment of a spouse by an unbeliever. If you're in a relationship, a marital relationship with an unbeliever, and they ditch on you, then the Bible is going to teach, Paul's going to teach, that is an exception clause for divorce and remarriage as well. You can be divorced in that situation, and you can go find someone in the Lord and remarry that person. So those are two legitimate reasons that if you are divorcing and remarrying for those two reasons, you have biblical grounds to do so. You are not committing a sin. Well, I mean, supposing you're the innocent party, right? What about all the other cases? What about all the petty cases? What about all of the unbiblical cases where husband and wife split for quote unquote irreconcilable differences? What does that mean? That means they're both stubborn and they wouldn't work it out. That's what that means. What about all these other reasons that the Bible doesn't give us permission for? Well, how do we handle those situations? Well, first off, if you're in a previous marriage and you're now divorced and that happened to you before you were saved, then just don't even worry about it. It does not apply. Whatever happened to you, whatever your life was like before Christ, all of that is washed away. All of that is cleansed. The Lord has given you that reset of conversion. And so as a single person now, it doesn't matter if you had 24 wives or 62 husbands. The Lord's going to look at you as a fresh blank slate and give you a new start, make you a new creature. For everyone else, Paul is going to tell them in the next verse that here is the first step. Here's what you do. If you have found yourself in a divorce, here's the first thing that you're going to want to do. You're going to want to, in a divorce, that's fine. It works both ways, for separation or divorce. Either way, here's what you're going to want to do. You're going to want to stay unmarried or be reconciled. You're going to want to stay unmarried or be reconciled to that spouse. Why is Paul going to tell us that? Because the sin that takes place within divorce and remarriage is actually the sin of sexually breaking the bond of marriage. So if you're married and you just divorce and you're both just separate, kind of doing your own thing, no one's making a move, no one's moving on, no one's getting married, no one's having sexual relations, technically, you have not broken that marriage bond yet. I know the government may have given you a divorce certificate, but you have not technically divorced in the eyes of God. That sexual bond has not been broken. It is when one of the spouses, whether they're present spouses or former spouses, it's when one of those spouses make the move and either engage in a sexual relationship or number two, they marry another person, which implies a sexual relationship. That's going to be the sin of breaking the marital bond. That happens through sex. So you got to understand that what Moses and Jesus and Paul have tried to do, first and foremost, above it all, is they have tried to teach the single life, the married life, the divorced life, and the remarriage life without committing sin. That's what they try to teach you. So when you're asking the Lord, Lord, what do you think about marriage? How should I handle this? He's going to say, work it out. Don't get divorced. Because he's trying to teach you how to navigate that relationship without committing a sin. But there is nothing in the scriptures that teaches that if we do commit a sin, in this area of marriage and divorce and adultery, fornication, that we have somehow landed ourselves in a state of sin. I always stress this. I feel it's important to specify this because I grew up with this understanding on the topic that if you were living, you know, if you commit an act of adultery, if you're married and you go out and you marry another person, divorce and remarry for any reason, that's the way I grew up believing, which was ludicrous, but in this case, for even, you know, even the accepted reasons by Scripture or the non-biblical reasons that if you do that, you're not just committing an act of sin, adultery, breaking the sexual bond between the husband and wife, but you're actually engaging in a lifestyle state of sin. And the reason it's so important to make that distinction is because if you believe that, then, man, the consequences of that are pretty serious. Because if you believe that by divorcing and remarrying another person that you're living in a state of adultery, now you have a big decision to make if you want to get your heart and life right with the Lord again. And what are you going to do? You're going to leave that spouse and you're going to come back to your old spouse because that's what groups like that teach. They think that's what Paul means here. Stay unmarried or else be reconciled. Listen, when Paul says this, he's talking about before the sexual bond is broken in a marriage. He's not talking about fornication. I mean, because obviously the law of Moses from the beginning taught us that that's the one thing you don't do. If you have divorced and you've remarried or she's remarried, then the last thing you want to do is divorce the new partner to go back to be with the first partner. The Lord calls that an abomination, something that's detestable to Him. So the way it should work is that before that marital bond is broken, this is what Paul's saying, before that marital bond is broken, okay, stay unmarried, stay separate, stay single, do not get married, do not move on. If you haven't divorced, don't divorce. And why might he be saying that? He's saying that obviously because there is a good chance that restoration can happen in that marriage. There's a great chance that after some time and space and thought and growth, that those two people who are just heading full speed ahead toward divorce can think differently, can let the Lord work in their life, and then heal their marriage. So, here's the question though. What do you do? You've divorced for unbiblical reasons. Neither one of you were faithful. Neither one of you were unfaithful. You didn't divorce for the abandonment clause that Paul's going to give us. This is a non-biblical reason that you've divorced. Your spouse is not moving on, and you've not moved on. That's a tricky one. Because, see, if you're divorced, and you've divorced for non-biblical reasons, if you do a standout, you can navigate that divorce and a remarriage without sinning. How do you do it? You remain the innocent party. What is adultery? That's going to be the act of that partner of yours, that former partner, going out and having a sexual affair or marrying another person. That's what's going to break the bond. That's going to be the act of adultery. And so if you're not the one that commits that act of adultery, if you're the innocent party in that, then when that person breaks the sexual marital bond, you, as the innocent party, you are free to go and marry another person without sinning against the Lord. Now, back to the question, though, what if you've divorced for unbiblical reasons? Neither person was unfaithful. You're in a standoff. You're both living single, divorced lives. Neither one of you is moving on. Neither one of you is having an affair. Neither one of you is getting married. What do you do? Well, I know many Christians would rather shame people for remarrying in such cases, but consider this truth that Paul has just dropped on us. And even if you disagree with how I define the word agamos, that does not change the truth that we're learning here. This truth goes hand in hand with what God Himself said in Genesis chapter 2, verse 18. He said, "It is not good for the man to be alone." That's not a sustainable situation. It's hand in hand with what Paul and Jesus both have said to us about the single and the married lifestyle, that it's a gift. And if you're living outside your gifting, that's not good. These are truths about the human condition that we cannot ignore. It is not good for a person that is incomplete outside of marriage to be forced to live outside of a marriage relationship. And if that person is really struggling with the passions of the flesh, then it may be, and I won't say this is my recommendation, I never give this recommendation, but it may actually be better for them to marry than it is for them to commit the daily sin of lust and some other sexual sin that they can't conquer. Now, I believe that's what Paul has just said. He's talking to divorced people. He's talking to widows. And that's what he has said. Here's what Paul did not say. He did not say that if a divorced person or an unmarried person, if you prefer, cannot exercise self-control, let them marry. For it is better for them to marry than to burn with passion, unless they were divorced on non-biblical grounds. It does not say that. There's no exception here. It does not say if you've divorced for unbiblical reasons, well, then you're just going to have to sit there and burn with your passions. That's not what Paul is teaching. The folks that are divorced for non-biblical reasons cannot be excluded from this truth about the human condition. So can you see now, folks, how people at failed marriages that have failed for non-biblical reasons, might wind up in a jam, like in a serious straight betwixt, trying to figure out what is the best thing for me to do? That bozo, just as he messed me up and ruined my life when I was married to him, now he's doing the same thing in our divorce condition. He won't move on. He won't break the sexual bond between us in our marriage. So I've either got to sit here and fight off these passions, these lusts that I have, these desires for marriage and a sexual relationship. I've either got to do that and displease the Lord in that way, or I've got to take the jump and be the one that goes out and pursues a relationship and then therefore commits the sin of adultery and breaks the sexual bond in the marriage. Can you see how that is an issue? What do you do? You can't make your former spouse get on Tinder. You don't want to encourage that along. So what do you do in a situation like that? It's a tough one. It's a really tough one. Is it better for me to potentially risk the one-time act of adultery? Or is it better for me to sit here and stew in my sexual passions day after day after day? Does that make it a little bit easier to decide? Should I, in looking for the lesser of two evils here, commit the one-time act of adultery? Or should I sit here and stew in my sexual sins day after day after day, week after week, after year after year? If nothing else, it should cause you pause in how you handle folks that are divorced. It should cause you to walk softly around folks whose marriages have just destructed and now they're hurting. It's a good principle always to walk very softly around those with broken hearts and broken lives. I'm going to give you an example of this. I personally knew a guy that really just helped me to see how important it is what Paul's saying here. Because this guy grew up in the same group I did. So he believed that if your spouse left you, that was it. You got one shot at marriage and that was it. As long as they were still alive, you were on the hook. And if they were still alive, if they left, if they divorced you, you were done. You could not move on, regardless of whether they were having affairs or regardless of whether they were completely remarried themselves. You were stuck And in order to please the Lord, you could not get remarried. So I watched this guy struggle with that belief. And let me just tell you very plainly, this was a man that was trying to live a single celibate lifestyle, and I promise you, he was not gifted for it. It was a shame to watch this guy. I was embarrassed for him because it was just like constant that his family would find pictures on his computer screen that were absolutely inappropriate, or conversations with, what do you want to call them? The chat gals, you know, online sex chats and things like that. He was constantly getting outed in sexual activity, trying to suppress this desire that he had. He was trying to fight against his gifting and his calling in life, and it was not working. It was causing him to live in a state of continual, regular sin against the Lord sexually. Webcam girls, that's what I was trying to think of there. That's terrible. The guy was clearly a mess, clearly struggling. I am a firm believer that if the Apostle Paul could have spoken to that man, he would have told that man, wake up and smell the coffee, dude. Get a wife. You are clearly not suited for the single life. You are not suited for the celibate life. The best thing you can do is, regardless of whether it's an act of sin or not, a one-time act of sin or not, the best thing you can do is just get married. Confess your failed marriage, because that's what you're trying to avoid. Confess your failed marriage. Ask the Lord to forgive you. Ask the Lord to help you to find a new spouse. And then ask the Lord to bless that new marriage. It's a tough situation to be in. I try to do it. Moses and Jesus and Paul did. I try to stay out of it and never recommend that. So I always say, hey, you know, do your best to hang in there. Do your best not to sin against the marriage. Do your best not to get divorced. That's always going to be the gold standard. But in ugly situations like this, we really sometimes do have to consider what would be the lesser of two evils. Now, you can disagree with that if you want. That's fine. But I at least want you to admit that you see the very real dilemma that people are in. And you see some conflicting principles and truths in the scriptures, right? You see that. It's not good to be alone if you're gifted for a married life. So, reading on in verse 10. To the married I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. So what's Paul saying there? Paul's saying, I'm giving you married folks a command, and it's coming from me. It's not coming from me. This is what the Lord has said on the topic. So if Paul's now recounting what the Lord has said on the topic, what's it going to be? I've told you a couple times now. It's going to be the gold standard. It's going to be the Father's ideal for marriage. So what's it going to be? Get married, stay married forever until one of you dies. Don't divorce. Don't mess it up. If it gets messed up, fix it. That's going to be what we're going to read next, right? Because this is Paul recounting to us the teachings of Jesus, the teachings of Moses on this topic. So the wife, he says, should not separate from her husband. Now look at the word separate. This does not mean skipping town for a few days. It does not mean going to overnight at her sister's for a few weeks. This is not talking about a temporary break from the marriage. This is the word charizo in the Greek. This word can mean separate, but it can also mean permanently separate. And for sure, that is how Paul is using it here. He's talking about a permanent separation. It actually is one of the words for divorce, and that's the way that Paul is using this here. He's telling that this wife should not divorce from her husband. The wife should not divorce from her husband, or the wife should not permanently separate from her husband. How do I know that's the correct translation, the correct interpretation? Because look at verse 11, it tells us. Verse 11, but if she does, right, don't separate, she shouldn't separate, but if she does, she should remain what? not separated, unmarried. You see that? So this isn't a temporary leaving. It's not a temporary separation. If you're having issues with your husband and you temporarily leave him, what are you? You're still married. Paul says, don't separate. If you do, stay unmarried. Do you see it? Do you get the point? Yeah, so when he's saying separate, obviously he is referring about a permanent separation, a.k.a. a divorce. So, you should be able to see there the proof of what I'm saying about these definitions. If a woman has only temporarily separated from her husband, how could Paul tell her to remain unmarried? She's not unmarried. She's still married. So obviously we're speaking about divorce. The text absolutely demands that it be divorce. So this should be translated as divorce. So is it any wonder that we struggle with so many interpretations on these topics in the body of Christ when the translations miss stuff like this so much? This is the ESV. This is a great translation usually. But I don't care what translation you're using. This section gets so confusing because of the poor way that translations handle this chapter. A lot of it is that they don't want to make statements. They don't want to make interpretations as translators. So if they drop the word divorced here, if they use it instead of unmarried, those are statements. Those are doctrinal paths that are taken. They don't want to do that. So they try to be a little bit more general and less specific, but they can't hide from the Greek language. They can't hide from the context. The context, the Greek language, this is speaking about divorce. So she's not supposed to divorce her husband, but if she does divorce her husband, the Lord would say, okay, you're unmarried now, and don't remarry. Stay divorced, or be reconciled to your husband. Again, why? Because there's a chance it could work out. There's a chance it just might work out. She might stay single and celibate for a while and say, you know, this is not bad. I like it. I'm going to stay this way. Or she might say, you know what? This is not good. I kind of miss him. Boy, I thought he was a jerk when I was with him. But, you know, actually, he did have one or two good qualities. I want to go back. I want restoration. I want to pray that the Lord will help us with the marriage. So reading on in verse 11. And the husband should not divorce his wife. So same thing. All of that applies to the husband, just as it does the wife. Once again, we get the Lord's position on marriage, and it's the gold standard. We don't get the exception clause for fornication here. But there is one, right? We admit that exists, right? That's why you got to be careful, because if you just read this, it sounds black and white. If you get divorced, stay single, or get back with that spouse. Is that like the one overarching rule? No, it's not. There are exceptions to this. The exception of fornication. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4. Matthew chapter 19, verse 9. The words of Paul. So, yes, and then we get, of course, the exception from Paul about abandonment from an unbeliever. But if you're asking the Lord, what are your ideals for marriage? What's your ideals for a marriage that's gone bad? He's going to say this right here. Try to stay divorced and give it some time. Don't rush off and find a new spouse. Maybe, just maybe, there will be healing and restoration there. So verse 8, just like follow this real quick and then we're done. Verses 8 and 9. Worship team, you can come on up. Verses 8 and 9. That's Paul talking to us. Verses 10 and 11. That's how the Lord feels about this stuff. And now in verse 12 for next week, you're welcome, we will come back to Paul's opinion as he tries to make sense of this all. All right, how are we doing? How did we do with this? Was it too technical? Did you follow me? All right. We're hanging there for the next week and we'll try to make as much sense of it all, tie it all together as well as we can. I'm going to have you stand with me. We're going to close in a word of prayer.